Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, Ken discusses the movie Tolkien and what we can learn from his life. Ken, for those who haven't seen it, this movie came out a couple of months ago, and there are some things you'd like to highlight for us on this podcast.
Yes, I sure would, Joe. I when I think about Christian apologetics, I've recognized that there are different spheres or different genres of apologetics, if you will. Reasons to Believe, of course, focuses on science, faith, apologetics. But you can engage in apologetics philosophically. You can do it historically. You can do it in various ways. And one of the areas in which the movie Tolkien kind of opens up is this whole question of what I would call literary or imaginative apologetics. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little bit about Tolkien in this program and the movie. And then in a future program, I'd like to look at Tolkien and Lewis and the Inkling. So some imaginative apologetics coming your way.
You're going to tap right into that imaginative mind of yours, huh? That's it. Not just logic that comes out of there.
That's right. I'm a poet and don't know it. So. All right. Well, let me introduce everybody to a little bit of Tolkien. I would imagine some of our listeners probably know a lot about him. I know on Facebook, I have Facebook friends that are supporters of Reasons to Believe, and they'll sometimes talk to me about The Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit, and of course, they'll talk to me a lot about C.S. Lewis. Well, let me give you a little bit of background and about Tolkien's life, and then we'll move to the film and kind of talk about it. J.R.R. Tolkien, his name was John Ronald Reuel Tolkien, and with his family, he went by Ronald. Hmm. That was the name that he went by. Interestingly enough, he's born in 1892, so he's 6 years older than C.S. Lewis. He dies in 1973, so he not only is born 6 years before Lewis, he lives 10 years longer. Tolkien dies at 81 years old. Lewis, which is, of course, they were friends and the two authors in the area of fantasy literature, two professors at Oxford. But Tolkien lived a bit longer, and he was born in what is now South Africa. Hmm. He moved to England when he was 4 years old. His father, who was a bank manager, died, and that meant that the family had no income. And so his mother moved him and his younger brother. He had a younger brother. They moved to England, and his mother became a Roman Catholic, and of course, Tolkien was a very devout Catholic. I'll say something about that when we come to the movie. But to tell you a little bit about some of his accomplishments and things like that, it's said about Tolkien that when his father died at 4 years old, his mother really began kind of homeschooling him and his brother. It's interesting, some of the bright minds of Western civilization have been homeschooled by their parents. Mm-hmm. But they said that Tolkien could read at 4 years old, which is very early. Yes. And they said he was fluent not long after that. And that, of course, opens up this whole world of Tolkien and languages. I think I read on one site, maybe it was Wikipedia, I've read a number of sites over the last few days about Tolkien. I think one said that he knew 15 different languages. And of course, later on, when he becomes a scholar at Oxford, he creates his own languages so that he can fill in the backdrop of some of his stories about The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Well, his mother, her name was Mabel, and she was a Roman Catholic. And of course, her two sons were baptized Catholic. And the story is that Tolkien, very early in life, would go to Mass, was very dedicated to his Christianity that was expressed in Roman Catholicism. His mother, unfortunately, died when he was 12 years old. And what I read was that she had diabetes 1. one or two, but there was no insulin available, and so she died 34 years old. So here's the interesting backdrop about Ronald Tolkien, if you will. He's an orphan by the time he's 12 years old. And so one of the great authors of the 20th century has a whole lot of suffering early in his life. I mean, I know my mother, she lost her mom when she was 9 years old. And my mom said, you know, her whole structure of her life was tilted and it never kind of came back. So Tolkien was taken under the guardianship of a Roman Catholic priest named Francis Xavier Morgan. He kind of watched out for the kids, got them into boarding schools. And it's Tolkien, when he's 16 years old, in a boarding school, meets another young woman. Her name is Edith Mary Bratt. She's 3 years older than him. That becomes his wife. So Edith and Ronald are both orphans.
Wow.
Kind of an amazing story. Well, from there, one of the significant events of Tolkien's life, like all men of that era, particularly in Britain, he becomes a second lieutenant in the British Army when World War I breaks out. This is called the Great War. I have to admit, sometimes I think I know a little bit about the world wars, and I discovered not too long ago that the British lost more men in World War I than in World War II. I never knew that. And when you read Lewis and Tolkien and people who talk about the First War, which doesn't get nearly the press, it's over 100 years old now. The war ended in 1918. The British often thought that World War I was more jarring than World War II. And if you look at the numbers, I mean, Tolkien fought at the Battle of the Somme, which is considered one of the most terrible battles in the history of World War I. You've got a million men fighting in a battle. I mean, just these numbers are hard to get your mind around. Well, he's a second lieutenant and a signals officer. He fights at the Battle of the Somme. And probably providentially, he contracted trench fever. This is lice in the trenches there. And it would go into their foot and into their bodies and cause fever. And it probably saved his life, providentially, because a number of his very close friends that are depicted in the movie are killed. And because he has trench fever, he's hospitalized and goes from hospital to hospital, ultimately leaves the army after. But here is another individual who, has this backdrop of military combat.
What age was he when he was in the service there?
So he's at the Battle of the Somme in 1916.
So he was born in 92, 24?
He'd be 24 years old.
Okay.
What I think is interesting is that he leaves the service, I think it is in 1920, and he and Edith are already married. They're married before he leaves for the war, and his first job is as Oxford English. He works for the Oxford English Dictionary, Joe.
Wow, there you go.
He is a wordsmith, like a few wordsmiths. Edith and Ronald Tolkien have four kids, and I think that one or two of them is still living. In fact, Christopher, his son, is the one that does some of the translating unfinished manuscripts that Tolkien had, and he becomes actually part of the Inklings, because the interesting thing is that Tolkien either didn't like to read out loud or wasn't very good at it. So sometimes he'd have his son Christopher come and read from The Hobbit or read from The Lord of the Rings. And The Silmarillion, which was published after Tolkien's death, Christopher has a hand in...
He's an editor, in a sense, for
all
of his...
that's right.
Reading material.
So you have many things that are said about Tolkien. For example, he's called The Father of Modern Fantasy Literature. In 2008, The Times in England ranked him one of the 50 greatest British authors since 1945. And of course, Queen Elizabeth II appointed him Commander of the Order of the British Empire. Mm-hmm. And so he's also one of the leading money makers for dead celebrities. this is something I'll say again when we do our program on Lewis and Tolkien, but I would propose, and I think I'm right about this, that if Lewis and Tolkien were living today, they would both be billionaires. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is that J.K. Rowling is a billionaire. Her whole series has been enormously popular, and she was influenced by Lewis and Tolkien, the Harry Potter series, if you will. In those days, of course, writers didn't make nearly the money, but if you think about all of the books, and now I'm going to give you some numbers. I'll compare Lewis and Tolkien. The Chronicles of Narnia has sold over 100 million copies. 100 million copies have sold. But Lord of the Rings has outdone it. 150 million copies of The Lord of the Rings has sold. And he became a celebrity in the 1960s, 50s, and 60s, so much so that he had to take his name out of the phone book, and people would just show up at his house. Mm-hmm. There's even a story that somebody wanted to do a movie of The Lord of the Rings in the 60s starring the Fab Four, the Beatles, and Tolkien said, no way. Yeah. Tolkien was not very popular not very interested or positive about the counterculture. Mm-hmm. He didn't think that was a good thing. But he, of course, has a long friendship with C.S. Lewis that we'll save for a little bit later. A little bit about his academic background. So he's an English writer. He's a poet. He's a philologist, not only reading multiple languages, but creating his own languages. He is an academic scholar, the author of the Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings, The Silmarillion. He's professor, and this is an interesting point. He's a full professor at Oxford. Lewis was always a tutor and a lecturer at Oxford. Tolkien held a more prestigious academic position there from 1925 to 1959, so that is 34 years. He is first an Anglo-Saxon. He's first a professor of Anglo-Saxon English at Pembroke College at Oxford, and then later professor of language and literature at Merton College at Oxford. So he serves there for 34 years. And what's interesting about him is here you have an author, and there's a couple things that struck me, and I'll tie them as we talk a bit more about Tolkien and his ideas. Here is a person who is an orphan, yeah, and a veteran of World War I. And, the more that I've learned about post-traumatic stress disorder, the difficulties that servicemen had. I mean, in those days, of course, they didn't call it post-traumatic stress disorder. They called it combat fatigue or shell shock. Those were some of the terms that were thrown around during the Second World War. But this is, of course, a war that was like no other war. I remember my friend J.P. Moreland, who's a philosopher and author at Biola University. He once said in one of his books that people who lived at the time of the Civil War probably had more in common with Abraham technologically than they do with us. And that technology explodes in the 20th century. I mean, remember, during the Civil War, which 1861 to 1865, in America's Civil War, you have single-shot rifles. They did a lot of fighting. I remember at Gettysburg, I think there were There were a couple million shells fired. I mean, that's an amazing thing for itself when you have to put a bullet in and reload. But by the time of the 20th century, you have airplanes, you have tanks, you have machine guns. I think Tolkien said that second lieutenants, and that's what he was when he first went in, the mortality rate of a second lieutenant was enormously high because you got to stand up and lead these guys. And here you have this machine gun that will literally cut you in half. So here is a man that had a lot of suffering growing up without his parents, going into a world war in which he lost a lot of his friends, no doubt feeling survivor guilt for those kinds of things. But he's enormously bright. So one of the geniuses of the 20th century was Roland Tolkien. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think sometimes when you do apologetics on social media, you hear a lot of the misimpressions that people have about Christianity. Like, you know, Christians are not very intellectual. Of course, that is the case. There are times where Christians can be somewhat anti-intellectual. I think that's unfortunate. But here you have one of the major writers of the 20th century, Roland Tolkien, and he's an absolute genius when it comes to language, when it comes to literature, stories that he's writing. And this whole idea of fantasy literature, I meet people all the time. I remember when I was first in college, I had a friend that was in one of my writing classes, I think, if I recall. And he was writing a report about The Hobbit. And he was just entrenched in it, you know. And I, of course, was reading C.S. Lewis, and we would talk back and forth. But I meet people all the time, and it's curious to me. Again, I'll pick this up later when we talk about Lewis and Tolkien. But I meet people who have read Lewis or they've read Tolkien's fantasy literature, but they know very little about their interest in theology. They're interested in philosophy. They're the worldview that stands behind it. I mean, the Peter Jackson films have been enormously successful. Not only financially, but also in terms of receiving awards. And so Tolkien is an industry. Interestingly enough, his family has never endorsed any of the films. They did not endorse this new film about Tolkien. And some people said, well, if the Tolkien family doesn't endorse it, it can't be a good movie. But what's not appreciated is the Tolkien family hasn't endorsed any of the films that have come about. I think that Ronald Tolkien signed rights, sold some of the rights to some of these things to ensure that his family would be well taken care of. And so they don't comment about a lot of the movies and books that have come out about him.
Mm-hmm. Ken, going back to his education and the fact that he was an orphan, you mentioned that his mother homeschooled him. Then she died, and a Catholic priest, I think you said,
yeah,
took him under his wing. So did that education continue through the years he was in some kind of orphanage through a Catholic organization?
Yeah, that's right. He had a guardianship by this particular priest that his mother knew, and she trusted him. And so when she died of diabetes, he would find homes, boarding homes, places, and Ronald and his brother were educated. And in the early 20th, late 19th, early 20th century, boarding schools, that was very common. One thing that does not come out in the movie, and we'll talk a bit more about the movie in a few minutes, but Tolkien was a very serious Catholic at a very young age. And so part of that connection would be with the priest. I think that the reason Mabel Tolkien converted to Catholicism, and I think one of the reasons why Tolkien himself was a devout Catholic, was that this priest cared for him, watched out for him, made sure that him and his brother had a place to live and were cared for. And so Tolkien is not naive theologically. He has lots of ideas. And in fact, his wife, Edith, she was not a Roman Catholic. She came from the family connections that she had, even though she was an orphan, were Protestant, and they were upset when she decided to become a Roman Catholic and to be married in the Catholic Church. That caused a lot of tension. And I might say something about that because I was watching. Anybody who knows me knows that I am a student of the life of President John F. Kennedy. And I've watched all these films about the Kennedy family, and I was watching a video with my son a few months ago, and Kennedy had a younger sister named Kathleen, who was unfortunately killed in an airplane crash right after World War II. Kennedy's had a lot of tragedy, but Kathleen decided that she would marry a kind of elite British fellow, but he was Protestant, and President Kennedy's mother, Rose Kennedy, said, "If you marry a Protestant, I'll have nothing to do with you." Those were times in which Catholics and Protestants didn't get along very well. And of course, that's kind of the context that Roland Tolkien finds himself. And so when he and Edith got married, and by the way, they were married more than 50 years, almost 60 years. Very powerful, and I can only imagine that both of them thought, being orphans, that family was very critical in raising their kids. And one of the things that apparently motivated Tolkien in developing these stories is he wanted stories to teach his kids, to communicate to his kids, to entertain his children.
He did a decent job of that.
He did a pretty good job. He's been entertaining a whole lot of other kids. In fact, one of the funny things is in the 1960s, Tolkien became kind of a college cult hero, you know. And so you have all of this attention. He becomes enormously a celebrity. I've wondered, will anybody go over to Riverside and see where Ken Samples live the way they do with Tolkien and Lewis? I think they do with Hugh Ross, by the way. He has kind of a cult following, I think.
There was some story about on the wall of the underground tunnel in New York. You know, there was a big Frodo lives.
It's, you know, it's... If I could stop for a moment and to talk a little bit about what I'm going to call literary apologetics or imaginative apologetics, I think that people are sometimes wired differently. You know, for me, I am a nonfiction reader. Primarily, it's only through coming to know more about C.S. Lewis and Tolkien that have opened me up to the reality that fiction, fantasy, those kinds of writings really grip people. And you know, I think that there are times where when you are very committed to reading nonfiction, I like history, I like philosophy, I'm interested in science. But I've met so many people who absolutely love reading fiction, fantasy, sci-fi, and that you can communicate eternal truths, you can communicate gospel ideas. You can communicate the Christian worldview through these writings. And I think that, you know, if you are overcommitted to one particular area, you don't realize that some people are very struck by another area. Mm-hmm. And so you in Tolkien and in Lewis, now they had different ideas about how to communicate their Christian worldview. Tolkien always thought Lewis was a little bit too forceful or communicated Christianity too overtly. He thought that it ought to be done very subtly and, you know, to find its origin in the story. But again, I have met some of the best read people I know, and they cut their teeth on reading fiction. Mm-hmm. And they find that to be a very powerful way of communicating the truth of Christianity.
My kids like fiction. They've read all the Tolkien and Lewis, well, many of the Lewis books. I remember when I was asked in high school to read Tolkien's Hobbit, I went to the library and I saw multiple copies of all his books there, more than other authors. Mm-hmm. And I thought, there must be a reason for this.
Yeah.
So I read The Hobbit back then as an assignment and enjoyed it quite a bit.
Well, I have to say, Dave, I think you recall that in May of 2018, of course, we took the RTB trip over to England. Mm-hmm. And one day was devoted to walking the grounds of Oxford University. And, you know, it's... I was struck by a lot of things. One is this school was here in the Middle Ages. That really, I had to keep reminding myself, you know, this school has been around since the 12th century. You would bump into various colleges because Oxford has numerous colleges and universities. And so, you know, the tour guide would tell you, well, this is where so-and-so was a professor, or here's where this event in Christianity happened right here. And, you know, we passed the bird and the baby, the eagle and the child, which was one of the places that the Inklings would meet. And you realize what a potent intellectual school and center Oxford was. I'm trying to remember the particular name. The man that took over for Churchill at the end of World War II, and I'm got to pull his name out of my mind here. Anyway, he said that when he was in World War I, to get away from the stress, he would retrace in his mind all of the steps that he would walk when he was at Oxford University. So here you have this remarkable Christian university.
Well, and it's not just the university, but the whole town.
Yeah, the whole town is right there. And by the way, and I'm sorry to mention Lewis so much with Tolkien, but I think of them together. Mm-hmm. But neither one of them drove a car. They were avid bicyclists.
Hey, all right.
And, you know, I think Tolkien later had a car, but he called it a jalopy. He didn't like it. And Lewis had a driver, you know, later. Mm. But their whole life, Dave, was around Oxford University. Mm. I know that they would go down to London, but I don't think either one traveled to America. I know Lewis didn't. I don't think Tolkien did either. They would have traveled part of Europe during the war and maybe other times over to France and various places. But you have that whole community right there together. Mm. And
Ken, I think I heard you say earlier, but just to clarify in case people are listening and wondering, because of the development that Tolkien had under first his mother and then the Catholic priest, he had a worldview already when he served in the Great War.
That's
so
right.
That comes out. I'm sure you're going to get to that.
Yeah.
That worldview comes out in his writings, but it was developed and he had it in place by
yes.
the time he served in war.
That's right, and that's probably a good jumping off place to talk more about this recent film. It's been out a few months now. One of the criticisms of the film, and I think it is a fair-minded criticism, is some people who critique the film. For example, Michael Ward, who is a C.S. Lewis scholar, knows lots about Tolkien. He came up with the book Planet Narnia, for example. It teaches at Oxford. has become a Roman Catholic. He was Anglican and became a Catholic, teaches at Houston Baptist University. He is really a universal expert on C.S. Lewis and maybe even Tolkien as well. He was critical of the new film, and one of his major criticisms, and I share the criticism, was that there's a gap in the film. And the way Ward talks about it is you're not really sure. If you're just to watch the movie, you're not really sure what the central motivation was for Tolkien in life. What motivated him to do the writing that he did? What motivated him to move in the directions that he did? And what is missing is that Tolkien was a very conservative Catholic at a very young age. And so his Catholicism shaped the way he thought about a lot of these issues. And the movie doesn't depict that. They do ever so lightly. They trace him being an orphan. They trace his connection with the Catholic priest who is his guardian. And I think there is even one scene where they're singing hymns. It may have been at one of the schools, but that is not well supported. And so you don't get the impression that Christianity was at the very heart of J.R.R. Tolkien.
Or played a very big role.
Or played a very significant role. And that's unfortunate. Now, the take that I have on that is movies often, they take creative license. Some people have talked with me on Twitter, on Facebook. You know, they say, well, this was Disney's, this was Hollywood's way again of stabbing Christianity in the back, you know, that they intentionally divorced Tolkien from his Christianity, from his Roman Catholic thinking. I'm not sure I share that. I think probably Hollywood is more motivated by making money than they are by depriving people of their worldview. But what I liked about it was that here you have a major Christian thinker. And yes, it's true, they don't explore his worldview, but I think that leaves it open for another film. I would love to see another film that would be more of an idea film, that would be more less a biography and more a development of his thought and his ideas. I know there have been a couple movies that were planned to explore the friendship between Tolkien and Lewis and the other Inklings, mm-hmm. but those movies have never made it to actually be published. I'm not sure why. I don't know if it's not enough money or whatever it may be, but probably money is right at the backdrop. But you know, one of the things that I would want to communicate is, I think what's very powerful is the biography. You think back to my book, Classic Christian Thinkers. I'm thinking to myself, how do I communicate church history and historical theology to my evangelical friends who unfortunately often don't know much about the history of the church? And I thought one of the powerful ways you do that is through biography. You don't just talk about creeds and councils and those incredibly important things and heresies. You introduce people, real live people. You talk about Athanasius, who is one of my favorite superheroes, who battles the heresy of Arius of Alexandria, for example. I think real life superheroes are much more interesting than reading comic books. That's just my take.
Careful now.
I may offend millions and billions of people.
Probably not the ones listening to this program. Oh.
Well, we'll see. If we get some bad letters, I'm going to direct them over to Dave. But one of the points again that I would make in that kind of context is, yes, there's some license in the film, and it would have been much better had they explored Tolkien's theological ideas and grounded it in a historic Christianity, a Roman Catholic perspective on things. But the fact that you have this individual and his life is spelled out, I think is very powerful. And I don't know if others are like me. I suspect some are. Maybe many are. The more I know about the lives of these individuals, Joe, the better I then can seemingly place their ideas in a context.
Yeah. Ken, it occurs to me now that I hear you talking about his life and work there, that one of the charges that skeptics of the Christian faith will have is kind of in the form of a question, is Christianity good for the world? And if I'm hearing you correctly, Tolkien gave rise to a whole genre of literature. And if that has been good for the world, then you could say right there. But you've also said it, now that I'm here thinking about it, in regard to Augustine, that he ushered in a new form of literature with his book, Confessions. So I think that kind of addresses that charge that, Christians can give rise not only to advances in medicine, science, and those kinds of things, but here in literature as well.
I think that that's a very important point, Joe. The reality is, and I, in latter years, and partly through reading Lewis and Tolkien, I've decided to go back and read many of the Christian classics. It means that I don't read as much because I have to give greater concentration to books that are more profound. But the reality is that you're right. Christianity not only influenced things like healthcare and democracy and capitalism, but it influenced education and not just broad education. It influenced writing and literature. And if you go back and read many of the classics of Western civilization, the Bible is a given. The truth of Christianity is taken for granted. And Christianity is again, people of the book. To reflect, to think, and to create stories, just as God is a creator, an artist can create stories, can communicate. And again, I think of the world in which I live right now. I think of people who just swarm to go to the movies, who will spend lots of money. And I went to the movies to watch this film, and I'm happy to say I went one day, and it was $13 to get in, and that was it could have been a more expensive time,
yes,
by the way. And I got a senior discount. I was very proud of that. Said, if you're 60 years old, so I got $3 off. And I thought, wow, I'm glad to get that off. But you have people, Joe, that swarm to go to the movies. They swarm to read fantasy literature. It can be comic books. It can be all kinds of things. And, I think that's where I really am appreciative of a Tolkien and of a Lewis. I am appreciative that there are people who've dedicated their lives to writing that kind of literature. And, when I write apologetic books, often it's just trying to kind of get down the facts and the dates and the arguments and all of that kind of thing. I have come to the realization, the real importance of kind of pulling people in, making reference to literature and appealing to things that are kind of a common theme in the minds of people. So not only do I think that imaginative literature and literary apologetics is critically important, it may be more important than what we think. Because a lot of guys, Dave is more interested in literature and fantasy and sci-fi, but a lot of people in apologetics are not. But I haven't sold 100 million copies or 150 million copies. These are really kind of extraordinary things, mm-hmm. if you will.
The thing that has been noted, of course, in many of the reviews of this, as well as, of course, of the literature itself, is that it communicates in a, I think you alluded to this earlier, in a non-religious way, the Christian values, the Christian principles. I've heard somewhere where when Tolkien wrote The Lord of the Rings, he had some more explicit references to God and to different things in his Christian faith. But in final versions of it, he removed a lot of that because he didn't want it to be in your face, to be overtly Christian.
Yeah.
And yet, when you read it, it communicates the grand design, just some of the comments that are made by Gandalf at various points to Bilbo about, you know, or to Frodo about what he's meant to be and, you know, how there is a grand design behind all of these things. And Lewis does the same thing.
Yeah, it's, you know, it is interesting, Dave, of course, that Tolkien was a little critical of Lewis. He thought his allegories were too Christian, overt, if you will. But you're absolutely right. I mean, remember that Christianity is a set of beliefs, but it's also a collection of values and a way of life. It encompasses a world and life view. And there are many people that read the Tolkien books, that watch the Tolkien films, that think about the nature of human beings. What are we? Why are we great and wretched, to throw in Pascal's ideas? Mm-hmm. How do we overcome the great enemies of the world? And as you watch the Tolkien films and you read the books, you begin to realize that, in fact, he does have a worldview behind it. There's an author that probably all of our listeners are familiar with, Peter Kraft, who is a leading apologist, who is himself a Roman Catholic. I think Kraft has written over 100 books himself. I've sometimes called him the Catholic C.S. Lewis, but he might be the Catholic Tolkien. He has a book out published by Ignatius Press. My friend is the president of Ignatius Press, a Roman Catholic scholar that I've debated, Mark Brumley, a number of times on Catholic Protestant issues. But Brumley always makes sure that there are good Catholic books. And this book is entitled The Philosophy of Tolkien, The Worldview Behind the Lord of the Rings.
Oh, there you go.
And if I just peruse, for example, the table of contents, Kraft talks about metaphysics, philosophical theology, angelology, cosmology, anthropology, epistemology, the philosophy of history, aesthetics, philosophy of language, political philosophy, ethics. You know, so here you have a first-rate philosopher, first-rate philosopher Peter Kraft, and he really kind of gives you the backdrop of a lot of these ideas. And again, Dave, you're absolutely right. I think if somebody read Kraft's book and then watched The Lord of the Rings, or read the books, you would see all kinds of things coming to life.
Enhance your experience,
You know, there's another aspect too that I really appreciate about both Lewis and Tolkien is their ability to write.
Yeah,
they just write with such engaging language.
Yeah.
And I mean, when you read some other fantasy literature that's available today that's trying to compete on that stage of fantasy, it just falls short. I mean, it's just it's just kind of, you think, oh, this is just a bunch of junk.
Yeah,
I
have
comparison.
I have to say that, you know, I have been the author or co-author or contributed to 12 books, but I still don't consider myself a writer. You know, a writer is somebody like C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, who spend all of this time crafting, you know, this particular kind of writing. I think it's kind of like when somebody asks me, "Are you a philosopher?" I say, "Well, not actually. Philosophers are like Plato and Aristotle, you know, and St. Augustine.
Right.
I'm just kind of a guy who reads about philosophy."
Right.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think one of the things that really impressed me about the film, and again, I hope that there'll be other films that will pick up the mantle. You know, there were things that were not accurate in the film. For example, you know, Tolkien is married to his wife before he goes off to war. So some of the historical connections are kind of out of place. But in some ways, I would compare it to The Shadowlands, the movie about C.S. Lewis, and that had a kind of a unique role to him marrying his wife, Joy. There were things out of place there. Now, of course, Michael Ward would say, yeah, but the difference is that was a really gripping movie. I'm not so sure that the Tolkien film is not a gripping film. And in fact, in just a minute here, I want to tell you some of the things that really struck me about it. But I was excited that a man like Tolkien, who I know has deep Christian roots, you know, and of course, again, a lot of this comes out. I had one person write to RTB and said he took issue with my review because I called Tolkien a Christian author. Well, I said Christian, parentheses, Catholic. And he said, you know, you got to be careful about calling Catholics Christians. So this gets into that debate, which would have been more intense at the time that Tolkien lived than even it is now. But the reality is that probably evangelical Protestants could agree with 85% of Roman Catholicism. So you have common ground. You have authors that have a lot of agreement. That doesn't mean the differences are not still significant, but you have when I look and recognize that a movie is being made about a great Christian thinker who happens to be a Roman Catholic in areas in which I may differ with, I'm excited about that. I'm excited that the big screen is talking about somebody. And I think, again, this opens the door. It leaves the door open to how about a movie that would really explore Tolkien's worldview? How about a movie that would explore the relationship between him and Lewis and the other Inklings? That would be a marvelous story to tell. Or, and I do like part of the movie. I like the depiction of World War I, because essentially what happens in the movie is the rest of Tolkien's life is gone to from the reflection of the war. You see him at the front. You see him fighting. You see him searching for his friends, and then they'll bring these events back in that kind of storytelling way. But there's a couple things that I really did like about the movie, and I encourage people to go see it. One of the things that struck me again is how in the world did Tolkien overcome losing his parents at such a tender age, living in a boarding school, living with people he's not related to, and become this brilliant thinker, this great author? How did that happen? I mean, we often talk about people who have difficult pasts, challenges, but here's one of the most influential authors in the history of the world, and he has a very, very difficult upbringing and very difficult experience. You know, the Lord has his hand on people, and I've always found it interesting in reading the minor prophets of the Old Testament. Houston Smith, who is an expert on world religions, he contrasted in one of his books between the gods of Mount Olympus and the God of Zion. He said the gods on Mount Olympus, they're all about seducing the maidens. They are, after all, gods created in the image of men, right? But Houston Smith says, but not the God of Zion. He's interested in orphans and widows and immigrants. I might say, by the way, that Martin Luther King, the great civil rights leader of the 20th century, took some of his preaching and teaching out of the Old Testament the Old Testament writers, who again talked about Yahweh having a concern and watching over. And I thought to myself how powerful God's providence is, and how powerful, by the way, this idea of soul making is. I'm echoing back to Irenaeus, the church father that I write about in chapter one of my book, Classic Christian Thinkers. Irenaeus said that the way God transforms our character, the way he grows our soul, is often through suffering, through difficulty. And, you know, who wants to lose their parents? Who wants to have all of this suffering? And, of course, people cry out and say, God can't exist or God can't be good because look at all of the suffering. But undoubtedly, Tolkien thought with a heavy heart that God was still with him and moving him through his life. So that really stands out in the film, that here's a guy who sold over 150 million copies of his book, and things didn't look too good for him when he was a boy. I can't imagine losing my mom and dad. That would have been very difficult, but a lot of people in the world can imagine that because they know it. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that struck me. The second point is, again, the cataclysmic effects of the Great War. You know, this was a war, again, like no other war. This was a war that took the lives of so many young people. I think when I was reading a biography about C.S. Lewis, I think it was Alistair McGrath's 50th anniversary biography of Lewis, I think McGrath mentioned at one point in World War I, there were like 18, 20 students left at Oxford. And, you know, the heavy losses. Well, you see this in that film. You see the mass of casualties. You see the hopelessness of it. You know, how do you find meaning and purpose? How do you recover yourself from that kind of experience? And, you know, I think back to my own dad. I know my dad shut things down in order to kind of make it through things. My mother always said that my dad didn't talk much about the war, but he talked more to me than any of the other kids. And I think because I was the youngest and there had been enough time, mm-hmm. and I was the most interested, I was always asking him particular questions. But I remember asking my dad, I said, Dad, how do you live day to day in combat? How do you function when you know that maybe in the next 15 minutes you're going to be in a firefight and a bullet's going to strike you in the head or in the heart? And my dad, who sometimes spoke with interesting metaphors, he said, colorful metaphors. He was quite skilled at it, I might say. Remember, he had a Catholic background, but my dad said, he said, son, I just decided I didn't give a damn anymore. And he said, I was just going to do my job. Mm-hmm. And I think that there were things in my dad's life that he had to shut down to kind of protect himself. I think that's undoubtedly true of people who fought in these great and terrible world wars. You know, when I think of soldiers, I think of them as people that deserve our respect. They deserve our empathy, our appreciation, and you know, you have a lot of people who fought in World War I. And you have a lot of people who had kids, young boys, in their families, and many of them were lost. That's depicted in the movie, where I think the movie does a good job of depicting some of the early friendships that Tolkien had. And some of these young guys grow up and go to Oxford together, and so they know each other. But at least a couple of the key early friends that Tolkien had were killed. And in fact, the closing scene of the movie—I guess I'm giving away. I guess I'm spoiling something here.
Well, it's been out a while now.
So. It's been out, and it's a historical film. I mean, how do you spoil a historical event? I mean, but people don't want too much information. They want to go enjoy the movie, and I understand that. But near the end, Tolkien has to go to one of his friend's moms, and this is a friend who has been killed. And she says, yeah, I have a friend, and she lost three of our sons. I only lost two. Mm. I mean, imagine that kind of cataclysm that would hit society. You know, the third point that really struck me, and I'll close on this and talk a little bit about some resources. I was really struck by Tolkien's love for his wife Edith. I mean, they depict a love affair. That is, here are two orphans. Edith's 3 years older. They meet each other. They fall in love with each other. She's a Protestant. He's a Catholic. You know, there's the war event. Of course, the movie doesn't get it right. They were married before and married some 53, 54 years. But you can see that, and I can only imagine that here's two orphans who have found each other, and they're committed to each other, and they're committed to their kids. That really struck me, how important marriage is. Mm-hmm. How important it is for my kids to know my dad loves my mom. My dad is committed to my mom. My dad protects my mom and cares for her. She's committed to him. She loves him. That really came out powerfully in the mm-hmm. film, and it made me again think that Christianity is first and foremost a set of beliefs, but it's a collection of values. Mm. And it's a way of life. So I recommend you see the film.
The this notion that you just mentioned is particularly, I think, significant in light of the career that he had.
Yeah.
That it would be natural for him to give a lot more attention to his career and less attention to his family and to his marriage.
Right.
But I think he's an example of someone who gave adequate and more than adequate attention to his family.
I think that's a really a great point. I mean, how many of us, even at this table, we've had jobs that are very demanding, that require a lot from us, and yet we have a family. And how do we balance that? Mm-hmm. And I think Ronald Tolkien did a pretty good job of committing himself to his wife and to his kids. Joe, I want to mention just a couple books here, if
sure,
I could.
Yes.
Of course, again, I want to recommend The Philosophy of Tolkien, subtitled The Worldview Behind the Lord of the Rings by Catholic philosopher Peter J. Kraft. I also want to mention a book that is written by a friend of mine. I'm happy to say he is a friend, Colin Durius. Dave, when we were at the Kilns, Colin was there and gave us a talk.
Oh, okay. That's who that is.
Colin is a recognized expert on Tolkien and Lewis. He was very gracious to me in reading the manuscript of my latest book and writing a very kind endorsement. He has a book entitled Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, The Gift of Friendship. Very, very powerful book. And I'll talk more about this in our next show where we talk about the two of them. So there's lots of good things to read about Tolkien. Might be great to...
What biography of Tolkien by himself? I know there's one by Carpenter that I read a number of years ago. Is there any other newer ones that...
Yeah, that's a good question. I'd recommend Durius. He has other books. For example, he has, I think, a handbook on Tolkien and his writings.
Okay.
And you get a lot of biography in Durius as well.
Okay.
Great stuff. Thank you for that endorsement. For those who have not seen the film when it came out, to be sure to take a look at it soon so you can get up to speed. And thanks for listening to the podcast. Be sure to visit Ken's blog, reflectionsbyken.wordpress.com, where you will get a nice article to help you along with your thinking and engagement with those who disagree with aspects of the Christian faith as well. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.